Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. As we listen to Bill Conti's classic theme, Gonna Fly Now from Rocky, we'll talk about this week's movies, The Rhythm Section, starring Blake Lively and Jude Law. The horror movie Gretel and Hansel does a gender reversal on the fairy tale. And Taylor Swift, Miss Americana, a documentary about Taylor Swift's personal evolution as a performer and a young woman. It's all coming your way on Film Week, as well as our critics taking a look at all three of the Oscar-nominated short film categories, documentaries, live action, and animation. It's Film Week on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at NortonSimon.org.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us, along with film critics Claudia Puig, the president of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, and Wade Major, film critic for Cinegods.com. We begin with The Rhythm Section, a film starring Blake Lively and Jude Law. Lively's character is a woman who discovers the plane crash that killed her family wasn't an accident, and she seeks out assassin training to get revenge.
Put another one in, never less than two.
Good. It's the easy part.
What's the hard part?
Living with it.
The Rhythm Section, directed by Reed Morano, written by Mark Burnell. Wade?
It's always interesting to try to figure out why films get released in January, which, of course, is
something...
Sometimes
it's not so secret.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious.
There's always something wrong with it if it's getting released in January. And in this case, it's a tone thing. I don't think they knew quite how to handle this movie. It's a female assassin movie. There have been plenty of those that have done very, very well. Femme Nikita, Atomic Blonde, Salt... And this certainly kind of aspires to that, but it wants to keep one foot very much grounded in realism. It wants to also be a little bit in the John le Carré camp, a little bit more Little Drummer Girl. And that's where I think it kind of runs into some problems. It wants to be pulpy on the one hand, but it also wants to feel very grounded in the other. And that results in this kind of very strange matrix of tones all throughout. And you're never quite sure how you feel about it. When you first meet her, she's really traumatized. She's, you know, a heroin addict and she's a prostitute. And that's a really deep and dark place to go for a movie. And they want you to feel the magnitude of that tragedy. But then at the same time, when she starts training to be an assassin, they really want you to kind of get your James Bond on. And Barbara Broccoli produced this, and it's one of four novels that Mark Burrell, who wrote the screenplay from his own novel, that's a series of four novels. So they clearly want this to be a series. I'm not sure that they're going to be able to pull that out of it, because it can't decide what kind of film it wants to be. And that keeps her emotions very much off balance.
Barbara Broccoli, that's of the James Bond.
Cubby Broccoli's daughter, who is now the godmother of the James Bond series, yeah.
The Rhythm Section's rated R. It's in wide release. Also in wide release this week, the fantasy horror film from director Oz Perkins, Gretel and Hansel, Rob Hayes. The screenwriter, Claudia?
Well, on the plus side, this has very striking production design and fairly impressive cinematography. And it creates kind of an ominous feel, but then it becomes a little tedious, and it's bleak and sort of Where it maybe needs to be a little bit more intense, and it's stylish, but it's not really scary. There is an interesting performance on the part of Alice Krieg, who plays the creepy witch that has this amazing house with the most amazing spread of food. Whoever was the food stylist on this movie did their job and then some. It's trying to be kind of an art house horror film. And I guess I give credit to the filmmakers for maybe some ambition, but I feel like the story is so thin. We were talking about this before, and it's thinner than which the original Hansel and Gretel, which, you know, is not a terribly complex story.
You can tell Hansel and Gretel in about 45 seconds.
Right. They get lost in the woods.
In case the title doesn't.
And the script here, I mean, the movie's 87 minutes with.
And it feels long.
And it feels long. It's 87 minutes with titles. And I would bet the script is probably 30 pages because most of this is just visual weirdness.
Atmospheric.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sound design and stuff that doesn't really make sense. It's
supposed to be kind of this feminist reimagining, or she's, because Gretel is older. She's probably like a young teen. It's not established exactly. It's not established where they are, what period of time it is. It's all, which is, you know, I guess sort of part of the fairy tale thing, but accents come and go. She has a different accent from her younger brother who's 8. And their mother hates them, and we don't really know why. She's descending into madness. There's just, you know, it's a story that doesn't really hold together, and you're not terribly interested in you don't find out the whys, and you don't really care.
You know, we get horror films that go, you know, straight to small theaters, and then you get those that are wide releases. What's the difference? Is it the production values in this film that made it a wide release?
I think it's the people that you get it to. If you can get it to the right people to green light it and say, we'll put it into theaters in January, then good for you. If you can't get it to those people, you get it to somebody else who'll put it onto video. I think it's the luck of the draw.
Yeah, and I think production values were somewhat impressive here.
Yeah, I mean, and it has Sophia Lillis, who is a big deal. She was in It and on television on Shattered on HBO. Which I can't remember, but Alice Krieg is a legit actress as well. So I don't know.
Yeah. So the talent, Gretel and Hansel, the film, Oz Perkins, the director. It's rated PG-13. Taylor Swift, Miss Americana, a music documentary about the performer. Claudia.
Well, I have to say, I guess I should start with a disclaimer that I am not a fan necessarily. I'm not a hater. I'm not for her. I'm not against her. I just, you know, and I'm not very knowledgeable about her. I feel kind of meh about her music. So it showed at Sundance and I skipped it because I went to go see something else. And then I caught up with it yesterday. So having said all that, I think the part that was the most interesting, it didn't really focus on the music, which is interesting. It focused more on her public persona and her development. You know, of course, she got her start at so young, and she broke all kinds of records by being so young. And you see her, you know, it's kind of cute. You see her, what she's like at 13, kind of gawky. And then you see her, of course, transform into this glamorous superstar. But what I appreciated about it, and it made me have a healthy respect for her, is that she's somebody who's been kind of dismissed as lightweight, and she's come into her own, and she's become more politicized. She's become more of a feminist, maybe largely. She says, you know, it has to do with the fact that there was a sexual assault case that she was involved in. At the beginning, it feels like maybe a longer version of one of her songs. There's a lot of, you know, she's about as forthcoming in some ways as she is in her songs, which is, you know, about breakups and all that kind of stuff. But then you find out that she has this political side to her, and or has grown into it as she's, you know, getting close to 30 at that point. And you see her kind of growing, and you see her navigate the shoals of fame and stardom. And that's interesting. Just interesting how somebody who is such a huge star has gotten there and has made their peace with some of the really difficult parts, the haters on, you know, social media and all of that.
Does it get into her evolution as a performer stylistically and where she's gone?
Not that much.
Because that, to me, is one of the more interesting parts.
Yeah. I mean, how she's gone from country to pop and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Not that much, no. It's more about her evolution as a person. And of course, the Kanye West thing, which, you know, derailed her for a while. She was so young, and she felt that when she heard the booing was was aimed at her. She didn't understand. And she said, you know, it led her down some paths that were not healthy. She had some eating disorders. And so it's revelatory in that respect, but not so much about her craft. And I mean, you see her in the recording studio, you see her, you know, coming up with catchy riffs, and you see how excited she gets, and you see she's very dedicated and she's a very hard worker, but you don't really get a strong sense of her development as a musician. It's more about her development as a person and as a strong feminist.
The film is Taylor Swift, Miss Americana. It's directed by Lana Wilson. It's at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema, downtown LA, also streaming on Netflix, and it's unrated. The drama The Assistant stars Julia Garner. Kitty Green is the writer-director. Wade?
I love Julia Garner as an actress, by the way, on Ozark on television. Just tremendous. And this is a great part for her. I just wish the movie were more substantial. It's a timely film. It's about a young woman who's an assistant at a production company in New York where she has a philandering boss. And
it couldn't be more timely given the fact that Harvey Weinstein
is on trial,
right now. Yeah.
And it is her job basically consists of hiding his indiscretions from his wife, who will call and throw tantrums on the phone every once in a while. And then if she doesn't handle it right, then he yells at her. And it really does kind of plug into the moment in a very, very effective way. I think it overstays its welcome a little bit. It kind of repeats itself. The scenario here is basically that there's another young woman, and she basically brings this woman she facilitates the hookup in this case, and then has to somehow reconcile her conscience to what she has done and whether she continues to do this to protect her job and, you know, will she never work in this town again, all that stuff. There's a lot there, but I don't know if there's enough there for a feature film. And it feels like it's more than a short film, but not enough for a feature film.
I disagree, actually. Okay. Yes. I feel like this was kind of a, you know, it's slow and it doesn't have bells and whistles. It's all really hinged on her performance.
And, which is great.
Which is great. And also
really,
kind of
really
a claustrophobic
good.
Sense, the kind of grimness of the location. You see how, of the workplace, you see how kind of miserable everybody is, you know, being terrorized by this overbearing, horrible boss. And then it's like a punch in the gut. I felt like, you know, because you feel how she's initially kind of wanting to assert herself, and she's kind of invisible to everybody. She cleans up after the boss, who's, you know,
she's
had
there,
all kinds
she's
of dalliances.
First, she's the first one there and the last one
yes,
to leave.
Yes, yes. And she finds the lone earring and, you know, cleans up after him, and nobody really notices her. And if anything, if she stands up for herself in any way, she has to apologize and write a very ridiculous apologetic email.
Which they all kind of help,
they all help her
with
her
because
do,
they've all
yes.
done it so many times.
Right. And you just see the dehumanization that happens. I feel like it's very quietly powerful, and it's an indictment. It's not a screed, which,
I
appreciated that it was so quiet.
And perhaps I'm a little harder on it because I know people who've been in this position. You know, I know what, and it felt to me a little bit repetitive at a certain point. And I didn't mind it so much.
I think that was the point, though. It was such a humdrum, monotonous job.
Could be.
And it was, it takes place all in one day, her work day.
Yeah.
And, you know, then she goes to the head of HR, who's like this middle management guy
is the best scene.
I love that scene.
That is the
Matthew
best
McFadden,
scene.
Matthew McFadden, who was in
Tremendous.
Pride and Prejudice as Mr. Darcy years ago.
Yeah.
You know, you realize
that's an amazing scene.
Because he kind of wants to, he seems on the surface like he wants to help her, but they all just want to hold on to their jobs. And so they're all, you know, complicit, basically, and to varying degrees.
Does it explain why the people all stay in those jobs?
Yeah.
Because so many of us wouldn't do it.
Right.
Does it explain why they do?
They all have hopes.
Fear.
Well, fear.
Fear and aspiration.
Yes. And then in the case of, you know, this woman who wants to be a producer and she's coming at the lowest level, he will be horrible and treat her terribly. Then he'll send her an email saying, you know,
passive aggressive.
Yes. Yes. Like, it's
I'm
sort of
hard
like,
on you.
Yeah.
Because
I see so much in
there's
you.
Greatness in you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're assuming that everybody else along the line probably got similar, you know, kinds of.
It's how the business is. They all are. They're basically indoctrinated in the idea that this is how the business is. And if you want to get ahead, you've just got to buy in.
And I think the younger people, you know, they have those hopes and dreams. And then when you get to someone like, say, Matthew McFadden's character, who is a middle-aged guy with probably a decent salary, it comes down to, you know, you have a mortgage, you have a family, whatever, you stay in it. Because the fear of you know, being jobless.
The Assistant is the film starring Julia Garner, Kitty Green, the writer-director. It's rated R. You can see it at the Arclight Cinemas in Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Also this week, The Traitor, which is an Italian drama. It's directed and co-written by Marco Bellocchio. Wade?
Marco Bellocchio, who's, I think he turned, if he doesn't turn 80 this year, he turns 80 next year. One of the great Italian directors of the last 30, 40 years. Kind of the godfather now of the Italian film industry.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. It is not exactly the kind of mafia film we're accustomed to. It's interesting more than I think really riveting. It's the story of Tommaso Buscetta, who was the mafioso, the Cosa Nostra insider who turned informant in the 1980s. And sort of brought the whole thing down. From just a narrative standpoint, it's very tight. It's quite interesting, but I didn't really find myself emotionally drawn to anyone.
I didn't either, even less. I think I didn't feel like it was very involving. And, you know, just the very notion of a guy who brings down the Cosa Nostra should be really interesting. But I felt like maybe because we were deluged with dates and names and meetings.
There's a lot of data.
Not a lot of, it's very data more than a character arc.
It's very methodical, yeah.
Yeah.
The Traitor is the film, the story of Tommaso Buscetta, the film directed and co-written by Marco Bellocchio. It's rated R. It's at the Landmark in West Los Angeles. Now, I hope that we're going to see you Sunday morning at the Theater at Ace Hotel, 11 o'clock Sunday for our 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Claudia will be there, Wade will be there, and all the other Film Week critics. They'll be on stage. We'll be talking about the major categories of the Oscars. And we'll be watching clips from the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures. You can get your tickets by visiting kpecc.org/in-person. We hope to see you at Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A. kpecc.org/in-person. Coming up, we'll hear what our critics have to say about the new documentary, Created Equal, Clarence Thomas, in his own words. We had RBG last year. We'll find out about this doc this year.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Wade Major and Claudia Puig. And a little bit later, Charles Solomon is going to be joining us. Looks like he's reading some manga, waiting to come on with us a little bit later in the show as we'll talk about the Oscar-nominated shorts, including animation. But next up, feature film for this week, the documentary Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. The film's directed by Michael Pack. Wade?
You mentioned RBG.
RBG early, last
yeah,
year.
Last yeah. year. It's very much the same kind of film. It's not as slick or as accomplished as RBG, which is a pretty sophisticated documentary, but it's very competent, and it consists primarily of a lengthy interview with Clarence Thomas about his judicial philosophy, his life, his upbringing, interspersed with readings from his book, My Grandfather's Son. And it is similar to RBG in the sense that it will divide people when you get to issues of politics and political philosophy, but you cannot deny what an extraordinary and inspiring story it is of how they got to be a Supreme Court justice, where they came from, what they went through. And there are all kinds of details here I was not familiar with. I was unfamiliar with his poverty as a child in Georgia, the racism he faced growing up, that he became a black radical after dropping out of the priesthood. There are all kinds of fascinating nuances and detours to his life that regardless of what you think about a person, just as with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, regardless of what you think of them politically or in terms of their judicial philosophy, they are still inspiring people, and where they came from surmounted numerous obstacles. So it's worth seeing. It's not it doesn't give any time to any opposing viewpoints, but it's not designed to. It's designed to basically say this is who this person is and where they're coming from. Debate as you will once you're out of the theater.
You know, as much as I enjoyed RBG, a very entertaining documentary, I wish there'd been more about her legal philosophy. It was more sort of about her activism as an advocate, but less about sort of the overarching ideas. Does it get into that in Clarence Thomas, his legal philosophy?
It does, not as much as it probably should. I think they made a calculation that they needed to spend more time on the Anita Hill situation and address that and let him address it and respond to it. And I think that's a little more sensational. It would probably have made it a stronger overall documentary for him to go more into depth in his judicial philosophy, but it does touch on it. So it gives you a taste of everything. Doesn't really give you a meal of anything in particular.
Created equal, Clarence Thomas, in his own words, Michael Pack, the director. It's rated PG-13. You can see it at Torrance's AMC Rolling Hills 20, the AMC Orange, and the AMC Burbank Town Center. The Mystery, The Long Shadow stars Tess Harper, the film directed by Daniel LaFrenz, who co-wrote the screenplay with Stephen Peltier. Claudia?
This is a fairly tense and involving pulpy thriller. The lead actress, Asha Davis, is particularly good. She plays a sheriff's deputy in a rural part of Louisiana, and it's actually shot, as so many things are actually, around Baton Rouge and New Orleans. It's nice to actually see Louisiana,
yes,
being Louisiana, yeah, as opposed to like Battle in L.A. or whatever. So anyway, so you get a very atmospheric feeling. It's kind of, you know, moody. Tess Harper, who is in it, and she's probably the only name person in it. She plays a rich matriarch, and she's a very powerful figure in the town. And, you know, it reminded me how many classic films she's been in, like Tender Mercies and Crimes of the Heart.
Such a good actor. She's called in on some of our Air Talk segments having to do with actors' issues.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
And I immediately went to IMDb and looked up her filmography, and she's been doing a lot of stuff in TV, but it's always wonderful to see her, and we don't see her enough. So that was great. She has a pretty small part in this. And there's kind of what seems to be an obvious villain, and then the sort of it's a mystery kind of there's a murder, and it involves this lead sheriff's deputy's, I'm not giving too much away because it's in the log line, but it involves someone she's romantically involved with, and it's pretty obvious who it is, who the actual killer is. So when it actually, the big reveal happens, you're kind of going, yeah, I kind of figured that out. And there's a relationship between the central character and her sister. It doesn't really go anywhere. It doesn't necessarily feel very true, but as a whodunit, it's, you know, only moderately involving, but I think just sort of as a sense of a atmospheric small town and sort of the people in this small town. And it's about a railroad deal that's threatening to displace people and their property, and so they're getting, you know, a lot of money for their houses and stuff. So it's generally pretty good. It's the kind of thing you could catch, you know, if you catch on a streaming service.
All right. Asha Davis, the star of The Long Shadow, the film from director and writer Daniel LaFrenz. It's unrated. You can see it at Lemley's North Hollywood one night only. That's on February 4th. The anime film The Wonderland is directed by Kaichi Hara. Mayu Mutsuoka is the lead voice in the production, The Wonderland. Wade?
Very charming. It's not Miyazaki-level charming, but it certainly aspires to it. And that's not a bad place to want to go. It is very much a formulaic Joseph Campbell hero's journey thing, but most of those tend to be the messianic journeys of male characters, and we rarely get female characters plugged into these. When you do, it's usually more sort of they've fallen into an accidental adventure. It's more Alice in Wonderland or Wizard of Oz. And in this case, she is a kind of goddess. She is a messianic figure, and she's not really aware of it, but she's discovered through by this sort of dimension-traveling alchemist who then takes her on this fantastic adventure, this young girl. And it is quite charming. Where it goes, you can't predict. You know it's going to go in that Joseph Campbell direction, but it takes some rather interesting turns and winds up being very, very touching.
The Wonderland is the film, animated a film from Japan. It's unrated and in select theaters. The Canadian drama Coda stars Patrick Stewart, Katie Holmes, and Giancarlo Esposito. Claude Lalanne is the director, and Louis Godbout is the writer of the film. Wade?
I wish it was better than it was. It sounds like such an interesting idea. Patrick Stewart is this aging concert pianist who's facing all kinds of emotional hurdles late in his career. He's experiencing stage fright, and then Katie Holmes becomes this. She's this music critic who's sort of almost the accidental savior in his life, and helps him sort of come out of it. It sounds like a great premise. It's a great pitch, but it's just not executed very skillfully. The music scenes are somewhat clumsy, and the performances are a little bit overmodulated at times. I've never seen Patrick Stewart kind of overplay a part, and he does here, and that's a little bit disappointing. And I feel like either the resources weren't there or the director just didn't quite have a firm grasp on the material.
It is a first time directing effort.
Yeah.
All right. Coda is the film again, Canadian drama. The film's unrated. It's at the Arena Cine Lounge Sunset. And it's the 50th anniversary of Ken Russell's Women in Love, Alan Bates, Oliver Reed, Glenda Jackson star. Larry Kramer adapted D.H. Lawrence's novel. Wade?
Yeah. Ken Russell, I have some interesting stories with Ken
Russell.
Personally? Yeah, personally.
We really want to hear those. Forget the reviews.
For the next 10 minutes, it's Ken Russell's story.
No, I mean, because I was supposed to interview him at one point with a camera crew, and Ken Russell never came down from his hotel room. He just cursed at everyone on the phone, and we had to call it off. He was a little bit of a crazy man. And so it's always funny to revisit his movies. And Women in Love dates, like, it is so psychedelic and funky, and it has that feel to it that we associate with early Ken Russell movies. But at the same time, it's still somewhat conventional. It's sort of before Ken Russell completely went off the rails. So even though it has that psychedelic, dated feel to it, it has a D.H. Lawrence sensibility to it as well. And Glenda Jackson won Best Actress for this at the Academy Awards.
And wasn't Oliver Reed nominated too?
I believe so. Yeah. And it's a terrific cast. It really is. You know, Alan Bates is really good. Jenny Linden is really, really great, and people have almost forgotten about her. So it's a fun trip to the past. It's a good thing to revisit.
It's going to be at Lemley's Royal Theatre one night only on February 5th. Your chance to see Women in Love 50th anniversary screening of the film. It's rated R. Now, we also wanted to revisit the Sundance Film Festival, which Claudia just mentioned, because that ended last weekend. We spoke with John Horn as it was preparing to open. And Claudia, you were there seeing up to 5 movies a day, I understand. And
yes.
I'm surprised your eyes aren't all bloodshot. But what really stood out for you? What you saw?
There were a few things that really stood out for me in terms of I was talking about this actually with John Hornist outside. A thriller, like a true crime thriller that stayed with me, was Into the Deep, which was about the Danish inventor who killed, and he's now been convicted of it, the Swedish journalist. And what they did, and
this was the guy with the submarine,
the submarine. He was also trying to build some rocket, and you know, when you first see it, it just so happened that the documentary crew was there. They were doing a documentary just about him. It's kind of the way the filmmaker put it was, I thought he was kind of just a crazy narcissist, but she didn't obviously think he was a murderous one. And so she ends up with all this great footage, and she talked to all the people, all these kind of young acolytes. It reminded me of like a professor that, you know, draws all these kind of young students because he's very charismatic, and they all kind of believe in him, and they're all a little bit lost, or you know, they haven't quite figured out what they want to do in their lives, and so he draws them all.
The cult leader thing.
Exactly, it was very much a cult of personality thing, and so the focus was on them, and then you know through their eyes you see how it's shaken them because they suddenly believe they can't, you know, they can't trust themselves to judge character and all that. So it's fascinating. And then on the flip side, it's also very dark, dismemberment and all kinds of horrible things.
Emma Sullivan, the director. And this is a documentary treatment?
It's a documentary treatment. And because the documentary crew was already there, sort of filming a much, what they expect to be much less interesting, they had got some amazing access and amazing footage. And then for a really charming and just heartwarming documentary, there's one called The Truffle Hunters, and Sony Pictures Classics bought it. And anybody who loves dogs, Italy, and Truffles. We'll love it. And even
if
you don't
love
good
things about this.
Oh
doc.
My God, it's so charming. It's just I sat there with kind of a dopey grin on my face as I watched it. It's set in Piemonte next to Tuscany, and you know, when you think about truffles being sort of rooted out, I thought it was boars or pigs that did that, but apparently it's old Italian men who are just funny as can be with their dogs, and they have this relationship with their dogs that is just so sweet. There's this one scene where this old guy, he has no wife or kids, but he loves his dog so much, and he has a piece of pear in his mouth, and he goes to the dog, and he's offering the pear, and he says, "Remember what the vet says, a pear a day keeps the vet away," and it's so cute, and you realize that the filmmakers were kind of flies on the wall, and these people were such fascinating characters, and technology hasn't really made it into their world yet.
You remember John Waters did Odorama for one of his films.
Polyester.
Can you imagine if it had
so
Odorama?
You could do it for truffles. And you just scratch it off.
You could almost feel it. You could almost smell it with the way they're all inhaling and everything. It's just so charming. It's
Michael. I was just going to say, Michael Dweck and Gregory Kershaw, are the directors.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's right. They were, and they just happened to stumble on this idea. They talked about this after the film. They were in Italy just on vacation, and they sort of, I think, found, you know, this world of the truffle hunters, which is pretty much dying off. You'd see these kind of younger guys talking to an 87-year-old guy saying, "Well, show me your special truffle hunting spots." And they're like, "No, I'm never going to show you." And they're saying, "Well, you don't have children, and this you know, knowledge will die with you." And they're like, "We don't care. Too bad."
You know, but you can still buy polyester scratch and sniff cards on Amazon.
Yeah. I didn't save mine. I scratched it all off. Yeah.
Well, this is an idea for Sony to hold on to grab onto here.
You got one more maybe before
The Go-Go's doc. The Go-Go's was a really fun documentary. And they managed to talk to all the women who were in the Go-Go's and who are now going on tour. It was very illuminating. You forget how, you know, their music was very infectious and how they kind of started off not being able to play instruments. It's like, you know, you hear so many of those bands.
So many groups,
yeah.
I was going to say.
Like the Monkees or something. But they eventually did learn, and you sort of see the internecine, you know, issues among them. And it was a lot of fun. It was one of those, it was everything about it. It was very tightly put together. It was, it switched back and forth between the days that they were a big thing. And you forget that they have not made it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I think part of the goal of this film is to get them into that.
And I would guess, given the median age of Sundance festival goers, this was a huge hit at the festival.
Women
I'm
of
sure.
a certain age, yes.
We're up dancing to the music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right. Claudia Puig is back from the Sundance Film Festival sharing some of her favorite films. We want you to come out and hear more from our Film Week critics. Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, our 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. All the Best Picture nominees will have clips on the big screen and a chance for you to hear from the critics on all the major categories. There's even a portion of the time devoted to audience questions of our critics, which spurs some of the best conversation as they disagree about different points in cinema. That's coming up in tickets, kpcc.org/in-person. Back with you in 90 seconds.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We got up on the whole Odorama thing, talking about what movies could have what scent attached to them for theater goers. Great to have you with us. We're joined by critics Claudia Puig, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. Animation Authority joins us now because we're going to talk about the animated short films, including animated. We'll talk about the documentary and the dramatic as well. So, Charles, start us off. We have five nominees here. Were there a couple that stood out to you?
Very much so. I mean, there's been an explosion in the production of short animated films. There are more festivals. There are more entries. There were, I think, close to 100 submissions for this category. A lot of them, though, feel very familiar. I would say one film really stands out in this group, and one's pretty good. The other three, not so much. Sarah from the Czech Republic feels like it's more about texture than it is about telling the story. It's stop motion. They try and suggest the feel of a handheld camera, but we've seen some much more interesting stop motion in recent years. Similarly, Memorable, the French short, is about Alzheimer's and a loss of memory, and there's a use of the textures of brush strokes of the artist. But again, we've seen this before, and in the last couple of years, I think we've had more interesting films about Alzheimer's. Kitbull, which is the one studio short in this group that's from, I think, Pixar.
Yeah.
From a program they have of letting artists try different things. It's a friendship between a little stray kitten and a mistreated pit bull. And it feels, once again, it feels familiar. And I think we've seen better cats and better pit bulls, frankly. Sister, which is a Chinese-American production, is interesting. But I would say it's a film I found interesting rather than that I loved, that is about a young man imagining what his life would have been if he had had a sister that his mother had actually been pregnant with and had to abort because of the one-child policy. Again, an interesting film with these sort of knitted-looking puppets. Some people with siblings would think this guy should know when he was well off, but it is a very interesting film. But
I feel like that one could have gone as a little in before the documentary One Child Nation.
Yes.
It would be a nice little lead-in.
It would have been a great double bill.
Yeah.
For me, Hair Love is the film that really deserves to win this category, which we've talked about before, that uses two-dimensional animation very charmingly to present the terror and resolve of an African-American father who has to fix his daughter's hair for the first time on a very special day for both of them. It's warm, it's charming, and it, to me, kind of represents the inclusion that Hollywood talks so much about looking for, and that here is not a thug, a drug dealer, a carjacker, a rapper. This is a warm, kind African-American father who clearly loves his daughter, wants to make her happy, and has no idea what to do, a situation I suspect many fathers can identify with. It's just such a lovely little film.
The directors of Hair Love are Matthew A. Cherry, Everett Downing Jr., and Bruce W. Smith, Sony Pictures Animation distributing Hair Love. Claudia, which for you of the animated one stands out?
The one you were just talking about, Hair Love, and I loved Sister. I thought I actually thought that was quite touching, the idea.
That's the Chinese one.
That's the Chinese one. And I think that's also, as I was saying, the documentary One Child Nation affected me very deeply. And I thought, this was a different way of looking at the same issue. And it did it in a really very poignant way.
Concur. Hair Love and Sister both made me cry. They are both deeply, deeply touching. I would say Sister would have had a great shot at winning this if not for Hair Love. You know, Hair Love is just such a beautiful, perfect. And Hair Love's one of the shortest of them. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It is incredibly efficient. Charles, is this the same team that did the Spider-Man movie?
A little bit of overlap, yeah. But this is something that Matthew Cherry, the former NFL player, it was an idea he had. He started to develop it and then got in touch with some of the African-American artists, of whom there are only a few, in animation, and they got together.
It's just beautiful.
To realize it.
That's
it's
another
beautiful
one that could go before a documentary. Remember the documentary Chris Rock did?
Yes,
Hair?
Yes.
Yeah.
I wonder, too, if in some way this film could be used as a recruitment tool to try and direct, get the interest of young African-American artists to animation.
Disney has two African-American animators, one of whom is a friend of mine, Marlon West. It's crazy. It's
out of their entire core.
Yeah.
Yeah, but one of the directors, Bruce Smith, with whom I'm friends, said, look, when I was a kid growing up in South Central, you didn't spend all day drawing. That just wasn't accepted. But that was something Kobe Bryant was very interested in. He had plans to do more animation that would not only reach African-American audiences, but would interest young artists from that community to work on and to try and bring them into that art form. He was very excited.
And of course he won the Oscar for the one he did too.
And you know, I would say too that Hair Love is probably the most emotional film that's going to win this award since Dear Basketball.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Yeah.
Which it made me cry too.
Sister really hit me with a gut punch at the end, and I watched that first and I thought, "Oh, how can anything match this?" And then I saw Hair Love.
Right. The right
and
order.
I just thought, there it is.
We're talking about the five nominees for Best Animated Short. These, by the way, the animated shorts, the documentary shorts, live action shorts are being shown at selected theaters all over Southern California. They're programmed together so you can see them one right after the other and make up your own mind about which you think are the strongest competitors, and maybe if you're lucky, you'll love all of them. That's the animated category. We move on to the live action category, and here we have nominees from the United States, two of them, three of them come from abroad. Claudia, why don't I start with you on the live action category? Your couple of favorites here.
One of them was, ironically, it's called Sister. And it's interesting that there are two shorts called Sister. This is a very, very different one. And it reminds me a little bit of a film that came out, I think it was a Danish film called The Guilty a few years ago. It's a very good use of the short format. It's a woman who is in a car. We don't exactly know what's going on. And then we piece it together. She's calling a dispatch operator and she's apparently being kidnapped. And so it takes place in real time as she's, but she can't, there's a lot she can't say. And so the dispatch operator is asking her questions. And I thought it was a really tense and interesting way of using the medium. And
Delphine Gerard, the director of that film from Belgium.
Right, and it's in French. The other one I thought was really powerful was Saria. And this is based on a true story that they recreated. There were 41 young women orphans at this Virgen de la Asunción home in Guatemala. And they were treated terribly. They're just being, you know, brutalized and just treated awfully. And then there's a escape attempt, and then they end up being sort of imprisoned in this one room. And as I don't want to give too much away, but anyway, there's a fire that happens and it claims 41 of their lives. And there were people nearby who could have saved them and chose to let them die.
And this was a real life event.
This happened a few years ago.
So it's a dramatization.
In 2017. Yeah, it's a dramatization of it. And then at the very end, probably the most powerful part is they list all the names. It's like
47.
Yes, white names on black.
I'm sorry,
and you
41
see,
of them.
41. Yeah. And you see them, you know, and the ages range from 13 to 17. And it just scrolls down. It's sort of like seeing, you know, the Vietnam War Memorial where you just have names in front of you like that. And
that's Saria, the film from Brian Buckley and Matt LaFave.
Very powerful.
All right. Wade, a quick couple of choices here.
As a not disinterested, not objective party, as I'm a producer on one of the five shortlisted shorts that did not make this list, so it's a little bit painful to look
sorry,
at this one.
Sorry.
Yeah, it is. But there are some that stand out. I think it's interesting that two of them take place in Tunisia. Brotherhood is the stronger of those two. NEFTA Football Club is a little bit flat. It just happens to have a really good ending to it. I think Brotherhood is a very strongly acted film about a domestic situation in a Tunisian family that has some really interesting casting and fires really on all cylinders. But I think The Neighbor's Window with Marshall Kerr, who's a previous nominee in the doc category, may be the film to beat.
Well, let's hear more about that movie, The Neighbor's Window. We'll continue with this category, the live-action shorts that are Oscar nominated. Again, these are being shown in full packages at select theaters across Southern California. Back with more on Film Week in 1 minute.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
Good Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Wade Major, Claudia Puig. We're talking about the Oscar-nominated shorts. They're being shown in full packages, all five nominees in each of the three categories, documentary, live action, and animated, at select theaters across Southern California. We're talking about live action right now. The Neighbor's Window from Marshall Kerr. You thought that's the favorite, Wade?
I think it's probably the film to beat. That doesn't mean it's my favorite, yeah. but I do think it kind of hits the check boxes that sometimes win this award. Marshall Kerr is a previous three-time nominee as a documentarian. This is his narrative debut with this short, and it plugs into film history a little bit. It's a Rear Window kind of conceit where you have a middle-aged family in a New York apartment building who they have kids and they have the chaos of being a middle-aged family, and
you see them as middle-aged. I thought they were
young parents. Young parents,
30s, I would say.
But they're
aging parents.
relative to this
very young children.
Relative to this virile couple that is just constantly going
copulating,
at it across the way.
Without kids.
Middle-aged. It's a grass is always greener kind of a thing, gosh, look at them, and they look at their own lives. And
is it comedy?
No, it's
there
not.
There are comic aspects to it, but no.
But
it's a very self-conscious tragedy.
It feels like a Marriage Story. It was slightly done by a lesser Hitchcock.
I would say of all of these films, Saria is technically probably the most proficient. Neighbor's Window is maybe the second most proficient. Brotherhood may be the best acted. A Sister is probably the best written. So it's, if you divide it that way, I think Nefta Football Club maybe has the best ending. How all that shakes out, I don't know.
I like how you break that down. Charles, quickly.
Sorry, Neighbor's Window didn't check any of my boxes.
Okay.
Let's all go be neurotic in New York together and make a film.
that's quite a few movies over the years.
I think A Sister is strong, although some of it is badly underlit.
All right. Live action category, we move to the documentary now. And here we have films, three of the nominees from the U.S. I'm sorry, four from the U.S. and one from the U.K. in the documentary category. Start with you on this, Wade. Your favorite of this bunch.
I think it breaks down to two of them for me, really. Life Overtakes Me, which is a Netflix-funded short doc. It deals with a thing called resignation syndrome, which is almost specifically unique to Sweden. Might be starting up in Australia, but it's a case where Sweden has taken in a lot of refugees and asylum seekers over the years, and predominantly in Sweden, in cases of people coming from from Baltic republics and former Russian territory, like the Crimea. They're experiencing this almost self-imposed coma situation where children drop into unconsciousness for months out of trauma, out of whatever, and they don't really know how to explain it. And they don't. And that's maybe the only thing that's a bit of a drawback.
It's a fascinating concept.
But it's so riveting because you I've never heard of this, and it's you ask there are a lot of questions that it compels you to ask. However, the film to beat here for me is St. Louis Superman, which is about Bruce Franks Jr., who is this 30-something rapper in St. Louis who ran for state representative and was elected, and it's a fascinating story. It's an incredibly well-made short documentary. It's beautifully edited. It covers an enormous span of time, and really they followed. It's amazing how much they pack into the short running time of this film, and it's very, very moving. And I think St. Louis Superman probably will win this category.
St. Louis Superman, directed by Smriti Mundra and Sami Khan. Life Overtakes Me, the one about the Swedish refugee children, John Haptis and Christine Samuelson, are the directors. Claudia, your picks here?
Those were my two favorites as well. There was a great line in St. Louis Superman where, he's a battle rapper, so he does these, raps.
That rap-off is great.
It's so great.
So great.
And he says, being a battle rapper is similar to being a legislator, only battle rapping pays better.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. Now, I didn't know anything about him, and I was really riveted. And the fact that he's able to get this, his Senate bill passed in a predominantly Republican state, youth violence a public health epidemic is just fascinating.
Unanimously.
Yeah, unanimously.
Wish they had told us more about how he did that and had fewer shots of him being a caring father. I agree with Claudia. He's a compelling figure. I think this is a very strong film. but I wish they had focused more on how is this, what must be an alien presence to the Republican legislatures, able to work with them and bring them around. I also liked, in the absence, I'm jumping in, a film that examines the disaster of the Korean ferry that capsized and so many students drowned. And there's a very compelling moment when the civilian divers, because the government had none who could do it, who rescued bodies and tried to rescue the students at the trial that led to the impeachment of the Korean president, says, "I've never forgotten this. It haunts me every day. How can the people like the captain and the legislatures say they don't know and they don't remember how this could happen?" I was just completely moved by it.
In the absence, Yoo Sung Jun and Gary Byung Sauk Kam are the directors of the film. Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, if you're a girl, about Afghan girls, was that?
It's good. I don't think it's a contender here, but it deals with these Afghan girls who enroll in what they call Skatistan, which is learning to skateboard, because boys are allowed to skateboard in public. Girls, it's discouraged and even persecuted. So this is it's very, very sweet, but it's
it
not.
Means well.
There's
it
another
means
film
well,
yeah. That was a full documentary, a full length feature documentary that was about girls learning to bike or being allowed to bike in Afghanistan. And that was really interesting, too. I mean, I think all that is such a worthy topic. But I thought that one was done a little bit better.
And as long on the subject of people in war zones and refugees, Walk, Run, Cha-Cha also kind of touches on that. It's about the cow couple, Paul and Millie Cow, who live here in the Southland, who were Vietnamese refugees in the 70s. And now they're learning to dance now that they're in their older years. And it's very, very sweet. But again, not going to be a contender.
Walk, Run, Cha-Cha, by the way, which tells the cow's story, is directed by Laura Nix and Colette Sandstedt. And Learning to Skateboard in a War Zone, if You're a Girl, co-directed by Carol Deisinger and Elena Andreychev. That's a documentary from the UK, by the way.
Quite a few women filmmakers, too.
A lot of
nice.
Women in all the categories.
Yeah.
These categories are much more diverse.
Yes, they are.
And not just women making the films, but women and girls at the center of the stories in so many cases. Yeah.
If only that was more the case with all the Oscars.
Yeah, and other ethnicities as well.
Well, isn't it true that a lot of talent, a lot of people get their start in the short film categories?
Yes.
And I wonder if this could be a preview.
Yes, and documentary filmmaking has been much more open to women than feature filmmaking.
And the tools have democratized.
Yeah.
It's gotten so much cheaper to make a film with computer technology that you could, last year we had Away, that was an animated feature that had been basically made by one artist. With very little help, you can do that now in a way that even 5 or 10 years ago, I don't think you could.
Correct.
For our Film Week critics, I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you for joining us this week. And a reminder, Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, all of us and more on stage theater at Ace Hotel for the 18th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Tickets are on sale at kpecc.org/in-person. It's an early start time at 11 o'clock in the morning. That because it's Super Bowl Sunday, we want to get you out in time to get to your Super Bowl party or what else you're going to do on the Sunday afternoon. We'll talk with you as we do every Friday and Saturday for Film Week on KPCC. And a reminder that next Friday we'll have the full 90 minutes of the Film Week special Oscar show, 10:30 till noon. That's Friday of next week on KPCC.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.